Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a bi-monthly digest of crime and mystery short stories, and our podcast series features author readings of stories from our back issues. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. For this episode, we have Susan Alexi reading her story, Variable Winds, from our October 2016 issue. Susan Alexi is the author of three mystery series. The Mellingham series is set in a fictional town on the coast of Massachusetts. Her Anita Ray series draws on her own experience living in India and features an Indian-American photographer living and solving mysteries at her aunt's hotel in South India. Her newest book, Below the Tree Line, introduces a new series set in rural Massachusetts. Following Susan's reading of Variable Winds, she stayed and talked with us a bit about her writing and her new series.
On a Tuesday in September, Annie Beckwith walked down the gangplank at the Mellingham Yacht Club. She carried two canvas bags in one hand, and with the other hand held onto a third bag hoisted over her shoulder. An old red canvas toolkit hung off the same shoulder. She dropped her bags on the float and waved to Lincoln Walsh, the skipper of the club launch, as he motored among the moorings. He steered toward the float. It was late in the season, and few went sailing on a weekday afternoon. Many of the larger sailboats had been taken in for the season, but Annie's boat was one of a half dozen still moored in the outer harbor. The Lady Mistral was an old wooden International 210, one of the first built in the 1950s, and practically a member of the family, as far as Annie was concerned. Her husband, Alan, wanted a new boat, preferably one with a motor, but Annie hung on for sails. The 210 was dark blue, double-ended, with a gray deck fore and aft, plain white sails, and a string of awards to her name. She was outfitted now just as she was the day her father bought her in the 1960s. Lincoln pulled alongside the float. "Just you?" he asked after Annie was settled in the launch. "Just me. I'm delivering Lady Mistral to Smithers Boatyard this afternoon. Alan couldn't get off work, and I asked Muffy to come with me, but her mother's in the hospital or something." "Didn't know she was sick." Lincoln turned the wheel and headed out. "Neither did I," Annie said, sitting on the gunwale. "Too bad about Alan," Lincoln said, "especially after all that prep work he put in on the Mistral last week." "Prep work?" Annie squinted into the sun and frowned. "You mean the extra battens he brought out?" "Are you sure you don't want Smithers to tow it in the way they usually do?" Annie shook her head. "I couldn't pass up the chance for one last sail." Lincoln nodded as he motored to the outer harbor and pulled along the starboard side of the Lady Mistral. Annie tossed the sail bags into the 210 and jumped in after them. She waved her thanks to Lincoln as he pulled away. The 210 was almost 30 feet long, sported two sails and a spinnaker, and usually took a crew of at least one, preferably two, in addition to the skipper. But Annie had grown up with this boat and often sailed it alone. Truthfully, she liked solitude on the open water. She pulled the canvas cover off the boom and folded and stowed it under the foredeck. As Annie snapped one end of the halyard onto the mainsail and raised the sail a few feet so she could slip in the battens, she listened for her father's voice telling her, "Take care of your boat and she'll take care of you." She smiled whenever she recalled his lectures, delivered in short spurts, little barks of wisdom. Annie pulled on the halyard, raising the mainsail. She leaned into it, fastening the end of the halyard on a cleat on the starboard side of the mast. The sail luffed and the boom swung back and forth. On the foredeck, Annie attached the jib halyard, clipped the jib on the stay, and raised it, fastening the halyard onto the mast on the port side. She jumped back into the cockpit. This was when her dad said, "Remember, if you want to be a good sailor, watch the boom, watch the wind, watch the sheets." She might be both skipper and crew, but she was never really alone on a solo sail. With both sails luffing in the breeze, Annie stepped back towards the tiller, looked up at the mast, and squinted into the sun. She stepped onto the aft deck and tried to gauge the two shrouds. Both looked to have even tension. She heard someone call behind her and turned to see another 210 sailing past on only the mainsail, the jib in a ready pile on deck. She waved, and the skipper and two crew waved back. She loved the camaraderie of those who lived for sailing. Annie threw off the morning buoy and jumped back to the tiller, pushing it over to port. She pulled in the main sheet, then the jib sheet, and the Lady Mistral was underway. Annie sailed out of the harbor close-hauled. The wind came out of the south-southeast, coolish and steady, and she estimated that if she tacked farther out into the ocean, she could run out on the first leg of her sail on a broad reach, a lazy sail to her mind, and eat lunch in comfort while she rode the swells. She held the tiller tight against her rib cage and watched the bow dip into the waves. Her mother thought the 210 a bit reckless when she first saw it. 30 feet, fast, all wood, but only two crew. She wanted something with a cabin, so she and her friends could take an overnight down to another club for a visit. But the Lady Mistral was her father's idea, and every member of the family grew to love it too. "It's unsinkable," Annie's mother used to tell new people when they joined them for a day on the water. When they looked skeptical, she pointed to the styrofoam ballast under the decks fore and aft. Annie rested her feet on the opposite bench and gave herself over to the sail. The Lady Mistral passed a small rock island, and soon the little boat had left the bay for the open sea. The breeze quickened, and Annie fell off the wind a few degrees. The ocean didn't frighten her. Its power and unforgivingness awed her, and it seemed to free her of the sense of the mundane. On the water, she could forget everything else and be fully in the moment, feeling the air, the rising and fall of the boat, smelling the salt and sometimes the seaweed. She felt the ocean in its incessant rocking and heard the wind brushing over it. It was a bright, sparkly day that told you how beautiful summer in New England could be, but also that fall was on the way. It was the end of the sailing season for most, though some sailed into October. A gorgeous day like this could be misleading, Annie knew. The waves rolling along the surface with their glittering shards of light and shifting colors could turn in an instant into a roiling, killing mass. She checked the wind direction and looked around her. To her surprise, she was alone. Any other vessel had sailed on, out of sight, and although she could see land behind her, it was far more distant than she had expected. She pushed the tiller leeward and let out the sheets, and in another few seconds, she was running before the wind, riding the swells and feeling the sun on her face. She moved to sit on the aft deck and rested her feet on the bench. She leaned back against one hand and stretched out her bare legs. Alan warned her repeatedly not to sit on the deck, out of the cockpit, and even her dad had pulled a face when he caught her doing so. But she loved sitting on the aft deck, the tiller in her hand, the wind at her back. Lady Mistral was an athlete, riding and diving and holding the wind, and she felt more a part of it from here. The sails billowed forward, the bow ducking and rising, as though eager to be in motion once again after rocking dully on a mooring. The sails spilled wind, the boom rose and fell, and Annie decided a boom vang was a good idea. She rarely used the device, a line of rope running from a cleat at the foot of the mast to the boom, to flatten the sail and keep the boom down. But she appreciated the stability it gave the boom in variable winds. She finished her lunch and went to work, turning windward to let her sails luff and the boom ease while she attached the vang at the base of the mast and pulled the boom in toward the boat. She felt the sudden chill that often came at this time of year and turned around to see a dark cloud crowded among the summery puffs. She was glad she'd brought a sweater. She snapped the vang onto the block, onto the fitting on the underside of the boom, turned the tiller, and headed downwind once again, letting out the sheets and setting the Lady Mistral back on course. She settled herself on the aft deck and scanned the horizon. The minute she heard it, she knew instinctively what it was. The language of a boat is made up of lots of sounds, just as a language has many sounds. Any one of them alone may not by itself have any meaning, but together the sounds cohere into a message. Annie heard a myriad of sounds, the wind hitting the sail in a different way, the halyard slapping the mast, the creak of the mast and the pull of the boom against the leech. She understood intuitively. The vang fitting gave way, breaking free of the boom. The boom rose, the mainsail spilled its air, the bow tipped precipitously, the boom swung wildly. Anyone else would have dived for the cockpit, but instinctively, Annie dropped flat onto her back on the deck. The boom swung over her. She heard the crack. When she looked up, she saw the mast split vertically, one portion dangling over the chasing waves, the mainsail dipping into the water. Another few feet, and the mast could have impaled her on deck. Over the years, most boats had changed from wood to aluminum masts, but the Lady Mistral had not. Annie slid down into the cockpit and grabbed at the mass of sail dragging in the water, pulling it onto the boat, working hand over hand to gather in the mainsail and broom. If the sail became a scoop, the weight of the water and the sail alone could capsize the boat. The broken-off top of the mast dangled over her. When she had positioned boom and sail safely onto the boat, she reached for the jib sheet flapping in the wind. Behind her, the black cloud had converted its mates, and a summer squall claimed the sea. The mast had split, but part of the upper half was left intact, and the jib forestay and shrouds remained taut. If she could get the jib sheet, she would still have control of the boat. The wind snapped the sheet out of her hands as she tried to grab it, forcing her to crawl onto the heaving foredeck. With her left arm wrapped around the mast, she knelt on the deck as she grabbed the jib snapping at her head. She worked her way to the sheet, pulling it back around the shroud and then through the block, re-knotting the end. With one hand on the sheet and the other on the tiller, she turned the Lady Mistral into the wind. The wind, fickle and loopy, slowed, but the rain began, cold and icy. She stared up at the mast, splintered and swaying, and knew it couldn't last long. The rain came at her like sprays of glass. If she crawled under the aft deck, she'd be out of the wind and rain, but also unable to see another boat nearby or any other hazard. Her shoulders hunched, she scanned the white-capped waves but saw nothing of any other boats. Praying for luck, she crawled under the aft deck, pulling out an old vinyl cushion to sit on. She crouched over, her knees drawn up, keeping an eye on the mast, waiting for the crack that was sure to come, sure to bring the top half of the mast down onto the jumble of sail in the cockpit. She managed some control of the sheet and held the tiller tight with a rope looped over the end. After an hour or so, Annie couldn't have said for sure how long it took since she lost track of time. The wind grew playful, but the rain continued, and the swells, though deep, evened out. The Lady Mistral seemed to settle into the role of a lady swinging her hips rather than a drunkard plunging among the guests at a garden party. Annie felt the tightness in her chest ease. She listened to the fading wind and the creaking of the Lady Mistral. By now, Annie felt safe enough to ease her grip on the tiller and sheet. She reached for her bag and her cell inside. It was time to let someone know what was happening. She felt around in her bag and found her cell at the bottom in a pool of seawater. She had pulled in enough water with the sail to soak everything. She punched buttons on the cell, nothing. But with the boat now sailing under her control, Annie felt less desperate and shoved the bag away. Annie found another pair of cushions and positioned them so she could lean against the ballast and stay relatively dry. Her one fear at the moment was a rogue wave that would swamp the boat and leave her to drown under deck. She scolded herself for her paranoia and began to calculate how long it would take her, after the squall died down, to get back on course. Without the ability to call Smithers or anyone else, no one knew she'd lost half her mast. She was on her own. The frame shuddered, and Annie leaned back, confident again, as she had been as a child, that the International 210, the one design that was meant as an improvement on the then ubiquitous 110, was unsinkable. If asked, she probably couldn't have said why she was so confident, since the Lady Mistral was all wood, wood frame covered with mahogany plywood and a Sitka spruce mast. The blocks of white styrofoam had been such a comfort to her as a child that she had never questioned how they might work. It was wonderful to take something for granted, to live without doubt and with complete confidence in what you were told. She shifted the cushion and this time heard an unfamiliar sound. A rusty coffee can clanked against the boards. Annie reached for it. She had often used cans for bailing, but this one came with a plastic lid. She pulled it off and looked inside. Annie tugged on a piece of paper and it came loose. She unfolded the sheet, the ink smeared from damp. She recognized the name of the local hardware store at the top of the receipt, but the notation was too much of a scrawl for her to read. The item cost only a few dollars. The purchase had been made a couple of weeks ago. For the next hour, Annie kept her eye on the boat, watching the broken mast sway in the diminishing winds. The jib proved more or less successful in keeping the small boat steady, and the white caps sank below the gunwales. The rain beat on the mainsail, filling its pockets with water, creating puddles all across the cockpit. Nearly covered with water was the pulley for the Vang, still attached to the bolts that should have secured the fitting on the other side of the boom. She had never known a block or fitting to pull away. There had to be something wrong with this Vang for it to fail. She secured the jib sheet on a cleat, crawled to the foot of the mast, disconnected the Vang, and crawled back under the deck with it. She studied the damaged equipment, running her fingers over an ochre-colored material, gumming up the threads that should have secured the Vang fitting to the boom. After a while, it dawned on her what she was looking at. Fake wood, plastic wood, the kind people used to patch holes in rotted windows in the garage, to smooth out the side of a bureau damaged over the years. It wasn't meant to hold like real wood, only to provide a cosmetic finish to damaged material. She'd seen this patching all her life, but she'd never seen it on a boat. Finishing a boom with that material was sure to mean failure. This fitting couldn't have held the Vang for longer than a few minutes before the stress pulled it free and left the boom to swing however it would. And that was exactly what had happened. If she hadn't heard the sound of something separating, she might have found herself knocked into the ocean and struggling to catch her boat, swinging wildly in the wind and drifting ever farther away, out of reach. She raised her hand to her chest. She wasn't wearing a safety vest either. Another one of her bad habits that her husband often pointed out. She'd grin and nod and wave from her spot on the aft deck. A gust of wind rustled through the shrouds, and the mast swayed. She rushed for the jib sheet, but she was too late. The mast cracked again, and the top half toppled into the cockpit, pulling the stays and shrouds down with it. The jib flapped, fell into the water, and sprawled over the waves, its sheet still in Annie's hand. She pushed her way through the sails and spars and rigging. She began to pull in the jib, soaked from the rain, and buckets of water splashed into the cockpit. This was the worst mess she'd ever been in. The only thing worse would be lightning. The squall had moved on, leaving rough seas and patches of sun in the sky, but that wouldn't do her any good if she had no way to control her boat. Three sails and no masts. Three sails, she repeated to herself. She made her way over the sails to the foredeck and knelt down. Deep under the deck, she rummaged among cushions, extra life vests, extra coils of rope for her one last hope. She grabbed hold of the spinnaker boom and pulled it out. Her last hope was a 6-foot pole she hadn't used in weeks. Annie dragged the spinnaker pole out onto the cockpit floor. Both ends were intact. She wasn't sure how much air she'd get with only half a mast, or even if this would work at all, but she had to try something. She recovered the jib halyard from the top of the mast and disentangled and unhooked the jib from the stay. She reattached the halyard to the top of the jib and secured that to the end of the spinnaker pole. Fighting the wind, she pulled the jib along the pole. The jib luff was 10 inches longer than the pole. She rolled up the luff, then she began to wrap and fold the jib along the pole, falling onto the sail once or twice when the wind threatened to pull everything apart. The sheets were easy enough to recover and coil. She carried the pole and sail onto the deck. The real test would be in how she folded the jib, and she would know in an instant if she'd gotten it wrong. Worse, there might be no second chance. For a long minute, she braced the pole against the remaining lower half of the mast and hugged both while the boat plunged in the water. As fast as she could, she lashed the pole to the mast with the mainsail halyard, slipping the rope between jib and pole as she wound the rope around the mast. She secured the line at the vang fitting at the foot of the mast, or what was left of it. She climbed down from the deck and arranged the jib sheets. The wind was already tearing at the folded sail, but she had no idea if when she unfurled it, it would catch the wind, catch too much, and immediately pull the pole from the mast or topple the whole thing. This desperate attempt to rig a sail could end in shredded cloth, a broken mast, or a deck ripped apart, or an old wooden boat capsized. Her hand went unconsciously to the life vest she was now wearing. Annie stepped to the back of the cockpit and tugged on the sheet. The sail head was barely halfway up the mast, but at least it was up. The boat shifted back and forth in the wind, taking no course and finding no direction. The sky above was clearing, but the rough water would last for a while. She checked the wind direction, out of the north-northeast. She closed her eyes and prayed. In less than a minute, the boat sank into a trough. A gust caught in the jib, and the sail billowed out on the port side. Annie sat on the combing, the tiller between her legs and the sheet playing out from her hand. The jib was now only half a sail, its leech dragging and catching the broken boom at times as it swelled and fell towards the deck. But it caught the air and held it long enough to take the boat onto a course. If she played the sheet well, the jib might behave like a spinnaker. She was heading west, but she had no idea how far she had drifted in the storm or in what direction. With her toe, Annie nudged open the storage bench, held the sheet in a calmer moment, and grabbed the horn. She gave 5 short blasts, waited, then called again. She repeated her call of distress every 2 minutes. Someone, somewhere, had to hear her. After more than an hour, a speedboat came onto the horizon, emerging from the graying afternoon. Its course was set to pass far ahead of her bow, but it changed course and came straight toward her after she repeated her call. "That you making that sad sound?" The man at the wheel called out to her. "Looks like you have some interesting developments there." The speaker was a man in his 60s, with 2 younger men, perhaps in their 20s. "How about a tow?" "Where am I?" Annie asked. "I got caught in a squall," the man told her. With great relief, Annie hauled in the jib and jumped onto the foredeck to take a tow line. In less than 2 hours, she was told, she'd be tying up at Smithers. In the interval, she did what she could to make the boat shipshape, taking down the mainsail and jib, stowing them in their canvas bags, putting away battens and lines, tidying stays and shrouds under the decking to keep them out of the way, and bailing. She'd been standing in inches of water without even noticing while she tried to keep the Lady Mistral afloat. Joel Smithers paced the dock as she paddled the last few feet. He caught the bow line and tied up the Lady Mistral. Annie was effusive in her praise of the skipper of the motorboat. "I almost didn't expect to see you," Annie said as she clambered onto the dock. Joel walked along beside the Lady Mistral like a man at a gallery exhibit, taking his time to view every aspect of the artwork before him. He stopped to stare up at the pale spears of wood sticking up from the split and toppled mast. "It needs a lot of work," Annie said. "I guess." He rested his hands on his hips and shook his head. "Your husband called earlier, said he'd be late picking you up. Come on up to the office and get warmed up. You look pretty beat." "Thanks, Joel. I'll be up in a minute," she said, trying to muster a smile. "I have a couple of things to do yet." Annie jumped back into the cockpit and ran her fingers along the underside of the boom, from end to end. She knelt down and slipped her fingers into the holes left by the bolts for the vang fitting when it broke away. The boom didn't splinter, with long, sharp pieces breaking away, as she would have expected. Instead, the bolts had come away in a clean separation. She sat on the floor and craned her neck to look up at the underside of the boom. The bolts had been put into the holes, where now fragments of plastic wood remained. Annie stuck her finger into one and wiggled loose some of the ochre-colored material with her fingernail. Someone had booby-trapped the boom and vang. Knowing a boom suddenly sprung loose could easily knock someone overboard or even kill them on deck. But when Annie had clipped the vang block onto the boom fitting as the boat sailed along, she'd noticed nothing that could be considered a warning. She crawled into the aft storage area to retrieve the coffee tin. She reached deeper into the can and felt something stuck to the bottom. She pulled out a small plastic tube. There wasn't much left of it, but she worked off the grime and rust and read the label, a 2-ounce tube of plastic wood. Beneath that was a worn-out piece of sandpaper. Annie unfolded the receipt for the second time and turned it over. She read the short note written in pencil, in faint but clear handwriting on the back. "A, here it is. This should do it. One good breeze, an old vang, her bad habits do the rest. By October for sure, and then, dash, M." The remnants of the afternoon squall ruffled the corner of the receipt. The cool air sent a chill along Annie's bare arms. Her clothes still damp, she felt every slip of air, every half-degree drop in temperature, every hint of surging water below the boat. But the fire of an anger growing deep within her began to warm her. The weakened vang and swinging boom had been meant to kill her, and almost had. Her husband and best friend had almost gotten away with murder. Almost. The story is set in Mellingham, which is a fictional town on the New England coast, very much like the town I grew up in, on the water, only about 5,000 people. And, you know, the stories revolve around Chief Joe Silva, but there are a lot of, you know, people and situations that I thought would be fun to explore without, you know, a police presence. And Annie Beckwith is the kind of person who grew up there with sailing in her family. And I wanted to write a story about sailing. I grew up sailing and racing a 210 with my mother, and she was a very good sailor, less so. But I do like being on the water, and I don't really get a chance, so I thought this would be fun. And I like Annie because she's somebody who you know, is undaunted by things that would be very threatening. And so as bad as it is, she doesn't feel frightened so much as concerned about how she's going to manage this. And she realizes it's a pretty bad situation. But she's not yet frightened, not scared, not yet. So I like her. I'd like to put her in more stories and do something more with her. And it's a little bit different to use the town without the police presence and the investigation of a crime. And so I liked that. That was fun. And I showed the story to the husband of a friend of mine who has sailed all his life. And so he made a few comments and gave me a suggestion about how to use the spinnaker pole, because I had it arranged so that he thought it would work better if I tied it this way instead of that way. It was very technical, but I understood what he was talking about, so it made it work. And it's about the only time when he and I talked and his wife had no idea what we were talking about, because she didn't sail. So I got this one. I've found now that I actually like writing about sailing, and I've put it into another Mellingham book called Come About for Murder. And I liked it so much that now I'm writing a different story, and I've put in sailing. And so I guess I'm going to start doing more of this, because it really is fun. You know, if I can't get out on the water, I can certainly write about it. And recently I started another series, and this is set in the Pioneer Valley, and it's very different. This is about a young woman who inherits a farm from her family, and she's grown up on the farm and thinks she knows really, you know, pretty much all there is to know about managing it. But suddenly, you know, her father is declining, her mother's dead, and there's more to this than she realized, because, you know, she could always ask her father something and or watch him do something, and now she realizes she's got to figure out a lot of things on her own. And there are some things that he didn't tell her. And she sort of vaguely remembers that her mother said, well, why don't you tell her this? And her father said, well, she'll find out. She'll figure it out when it's time. And she's trying to remember, what was I supposed to figure out? And is this the time? Because I have all these questions now. So that's a very different story. But it's once again a young woman faced with challenges, and she's resourceful, and she figures things out. Below the Tree Line, it's a lot about what goes on in the forest and her property.
Thank you, Susan Alexi, for your reading and discussion. We recorded this podcast at the 2018 New England Crime Bait Conference outside of Boston. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes 6 double issues a year. To learn more about us, visit our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available from all e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for joining us.